Hi, everyone. This is podcast 2 of the Cancer Overview. We are starting on slide 14 that starts just looking at just different pictures of different cancers that are quite obvious in these slides. So there's not a whole lot to say because I wrote the words right on the slides themselves. But this one is a grade 4 retinoblastoma of a little girl, and that is just quite sad to look at on that first slide. The next one on slide 15 is a stage 4 breast cancer. It's kind of hard to see on your black and white slides. On slide 16 is a large benign facial tumor, and there's a before and an after picture. She was on the news a few years ago, so I don't know if you remember her little picture, but she, I believe, is doing still quite well today. The next picture shows a large uterine tumor that had been removed. Generally, your uterus is the size of your fist, so that one is probably the size of about 4 fists there. The other picture, that's a lady's face, if you're looking at it, and it shows some basal skin cells, cancer there on her face. Sunscreen is very, very important. The next one are squamous cell skin cancers. The next one, slide 20, shows a melanoma. The last one, you have to look pretty close in the eye there, but there is a melanoma of the iris itself just to the left of the pupil. You can see kind of a, I don't want to say a lump in the iris, but it's right there. So you can see that. So let's talk, now that we've seen what the cancer is, some different pictures of cancer, how do we treat it? What do we do? The first thing we're going to think about generally, what people want to do is just remove it, get it out of my body. So surgery is something that we're going to think about. Surgery can be done prophylactically for pre-malignancy or tissue removal with the highest risk. Again, sometimes women will have both breasts removed, especially if they have a history, if they're carrying the cancer gene, or if they have cancer in one breast, they'll have the other breast removed. They may do surgery for diagnosis, as like taking a biopsy. The surgery itself may be as a cure, where they can actually remove the entire tumor. Hopefully it is encapsulated. They may use surgery to help just control the tumor. They think of that's also known as being cytoprotective. A term I want you to remember and know is debulking. This basically, all this does is it goes in and it reduces tumor size to improve the effects of the therapy. It's not a cure. It's not removing the entire cancer. And there are various reasons that they're going to leave it, bleeding risk, infection risk, those types of things, if they feel that the radiation and chemo can be effective in those areas. But debulking means we're just going to go in and remove what we can, get rid of the worst of it so the treatment can be more effective. The other thing is palliative, improve the quality of survival time. So the surgery may not give them a cure it and make it go away, but it may give them another 3 months or 6 months to live. They may go in and just have surgery to relook at things, how effective was their treatment. And they also do surgery reconstructively, depending on where the cancer was and where it was removed. A lot of women and some men even have some breast reconstruction done if they have breast cancer. Other treatments besides surgery include radiation, chemotherapy, and the biological agents and targeted therapies. And the next few slides are going to go through what each of those are. So let's start talking about radiation or radiotherapy. More than 50% of cancer patients are actually going to receive radiation at some stage throughout the course of their cancer. This treats localized solid tumors, such as cancers of the skin, brain, breast, or cervix, and can be used to treat also leukemia or lymphomas. The hard part about radiation is it damages the DNA material in the tumor cells, making them unable to divide and grow, which is awesome. But normal cells are also inevitably damaged. So you're not... With radiation, it's not just targeting the bad cells, although the radiation we have today, even within the last few years, has gotten quite precise that we're having fewer normal cells that are being killed. So that's the good news there. The cell death actually occurs hours, days, or years after the treatment, and radiation works by limiting cell repair and therefore slowing the growth of the cells. The therapy itself aims to minimize the dose to normal cells and maximize the dose to the tumor cells. We want to hit that ray right where we need to. And it can be curative which means they're hoping to totally kill or reduce the tumor size. Or again, it can be palliative, just like we had mentioned with surgery, where it is just used to relieve an obstruction or decrease the pain and possibly prolong their survival for a little bit of time, but the radiation may not completely cure the cancer. Generally, radiation is not used alone. It is going to be used in combination with surgery and or chemo as well. So there are some cellular factors that influence our response to radiation. Depending on where it happens in the cell cycle, the cells are most vulnerable to the disruptive effects of radiation during the DNA synthesis and mitosis, and you don't necessarily need to memorize that. But it's not going to, basically, depending on where that cell is in its cycle, it's not going to kill every single cell with one treatment. So generally, it's going to require multiple treatments to get those cells because it's going to damage them at different parts of their life cycle. Also, oxygenation. Tumors that are well oxygenated are more sensitive to radiation. Radiation therapy might be enhanced if oxygen concentrations to tumors could be increased. So hyperoxygenation. Well, vascularized cells are also more responsive to radiation. Some of the types of radiation that are out there include external beam radiation therapy, EBRT, with linear accelerators. And there's a list of those there, the IGRT, IMRT, proton beam radiation, cyber knife. We're not testing on those specific ones by any means. But it's just important to know that there are various forms of radiation that we can use, external radiation for the client, to specifically do the job that we need it to do for specific types of cancers. So remember, this is external beam radiation. So the patient is going to actually lay on a board, and there are pictures in your textbook that show this. It's kind of like an x-ray machine is what this radiation thing looks like. And we'll talk about it here in the next couple slides a little more in depth. But it's actually shot initially, the source of the radiation is outside of the person's body. There's also a type of radiation that they can do as internal radiation. It can be known as brachytherapy. Sometimes they interchange internal radiation with brachytherapy. They can be in the prostate, breast, and gynecological areas. A lot of times where we're going to see that, the radiation is implanted within the patient and left there for a specific amount of time. And we're going to, again, go through these a little bit more in depth through the next few slides. So let's talk a little bit about external radiation. Radiation oncologists actually mark specific locations using a semi-permanent marker. So they actually mark the patient's skin for the exact locations where they want it to go. Treatment usually lasts about 15 to 30 minutes daily, 5 days per week for 2 to 7 weeks. Depending on the type of external radiation, the type of cancer, the patient characteristics, all of that can change from person to person, but it generally can be quite extensive for a short amount of time. This patient does not pose a risk for radiation exposure to other people. Again, remember the source of the radiation is external. So when the patient leaves, they're not going to stay radioactive because they don't have radioactive beads or things within the body. So it's okay. We don't have to use any special precautions when working with patients who have had external beam radiation. Some of the side effects that we're going to see include tissue damage to the targeted area, some redness, some erythema, some sloughing, can even have some hemorrhage from tissue irritation. There can be ulcerations of oral mucosa membranes, some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea. They can have radiation pneumonia, especially if we're radiating the lung tissue or anywhere on the chest. It can damage some of those good cells, and therefore we're not getting good oxygen through those areas, and it's more prone to the development of pneumonia. As we're killing different cells throughout the body, we're also killing the good ones as well. So remember, fatigue is part of that. We're going to be killing hair cells, possibly, so alopecia, and immunosuppression may all fall into side effects of the external radiation. So what are we going to do? What are we going to teach our patient when they're having external radiation? Make sure that the patient, when they leave, they do not wash off the area that the physician has marked. So avoid rubbing, scratching, and scrubbing the treatment site. If they're shaving, have them use an electric razor that's not taking off skin cells as closely to the skin. So do not use soaps, deodorant, lotion, perfume, powders, or meds on the site during the duration of the treatment, and obviously do not wash off the treatment marks. They may be prescribed some creams or lotions, especially if their skin gets red and starts to break down, or if they're hypersensitive. They need to wear soft, loose-fitting clothes over the treatment area, protect the skin, from sun exposure during the treatment and at least 1 year after it's completed. They're going to be very photosensitive in that area and burn, and the last thing we'd want them is to develop a skin cancer in the area of treatment. Maintain proper rest, diet, and fluid intake. These are essential just for maintaining normal immune function within the body, or as normal as possible through this process. Hair loss planning, again, if they're thinking they're going to be having hair loss with radiation, we see it more frequently with chemo, but again, they use them in combination, so we can sometimes put those together. So hair loss planning, do they need a wig, hat, scarf? How are they planning to keep their self-esteem and their self-confidence, even though they may be losing hair? If we look at the next slide, so how can we prevent some of the normal tissue complications that can occur? How do we prevent heart and pulmonary damage? Obviously, we try to keep them as hydrated as possible. Cough and deep breathe. Some of these things we can just think about in the past. What would we do and how would we treat anyone who would have these possible complications? It's not much different. So for GI and mucositis, nausea and vomiting, make sure we're well hydrated. Make sure Vaseline, they can use Vaseline if an area is getting too dry in their mouth or around their lips. Hair loss, we will obviously do a wig or counseling. If there's liver, to prevent liver damage, again, eating healthy, staying well hydrated are going to be the best things we can do. Hypersensitivity can occur, as well as skin fibrosis. So use the lotion that's prescribed to them, not necessarily over-the-counter lotions that could make things worse. Also just general powders, and avoid sun to that area. Oral complications, we talked about that. Staying well hydrated, sometimes having sucker candy or lemon drops, they say is helpful with maintaining good saliva and moisture within the mouth. Immunosuppression, again, good nutrition, protein, vitamin C are going to be needed to be high in the diet for the patients to stay as healthy as possible. They may have sexual complications, dryness and infertility are a couple things. And so family planning, generally something, especially the younger couples who this affects, needs to be an area that needs to be addressed prior to starting treatment. With head and neck, they have an increased risk of a stroke due to scarring and narrowing of the vessels, especially if it's radiation to that neck. And so how do we keep the blood thin? Maintaining good blood flow to the head and rest of the body is going to be essential for us to monitor. Some other things on the next slide just kind of continues down that, and I kind of talked about that as I went through each one. So the importance of diet, vitamins, and supplements have been found to be good. They may need sperm banking, fertility for men, and then fertility in women, embryo freezing, egg freezing, ovarian tissue freezing, ovarian transposition, or there's so many others anymore, we can't even list them all. So just trying to plan ahead, knowing what the complications are and how can we help the patient overcome those. The next slide, slide 30, just is a picture of an external beam radiation system. Trilogy is what the name of that one is. And I know at one point those were pretty common throughout a lot of the facilities in our area. Because of the importance of hitting exactly the location where the radiation needs to be, a lot of times you'll see a mold care head cushion where it actually transform around the head. To me, this would be very hard to probably be in. I'd probably be claustrophobic, but it actually is an immobilization device for the heads just to make sure the patient is as still as possible. There's actually a place in Orange City that makes some of these, which is kind of cool. All right, that basically sums up our external radiation. Let's talk for a few minutes here about internal radiation, also known basically as brachytherapy. And this is the radiation source actually comes in direct contact continuously with the tumor tissue for a specific amount of time. So the radiation source is actually put within the patient themselves. It can be either sealed or unsealed sources of radiation that they're going to put within the body. So the length of the administration actually depends on the radioactive half-life of the isotope that they're going to be using. This radiation, again, can be used in combination with external treatment, depending on what the oncologist orders. There are different types of internal radiation, and we'll talk a little bit about each of these, but there's intracavity, such as in the bladder, interstitial within the tissues. It can be systemic, where they'll give it either IV or orally, so it'll go to all parts of the body. Intraperitoneal in the uterus, or intrathoracic, that's actually somewhere into the chest area. And so let's go through the next slides and talk about each one of those a little bit more. So for the implants, it can be actually needles, seeds, beads, or catheters, and that can be used to implant radioactive sources within the body. And it gives you a whole list there of places where those can actually be done. And if you are really interested in what some of those pictures are of needle implants and seeds and beads, I have pictures of beads, I believe, in the PowerPoint, or seeds. But the rest of them, you can just Google images and you'll get lots of pictures if you'd like to see what they actually look like. So let's talk a little bit about the intracavity implants. It is sealed, so it is a solid implant. It is a radioactive at low levels. So if it falls out, it needs to use special precautions to retrieve and dispose of the implant. Secretions and bodily fluids are not necessarily radioactive because it is sealed. So it's not exposing throughout the whole body in that area. It's put into the organ. It's a solid implant and it just works right within that organ itself. Systemic radiation, internal radiation taken orally. They're usually I-123 or I-131 or IV. When we take them systemically, those are unsealed and gives off low doses of radioactivity in their urine, in their saliva, those types of things. And we'll talk about radiation safety here in the next slides. There's also interstitial or seed implant radiation. This is sealed, again, low doses of radiation, and it's very localized. Secretions and body fluids are not radioactive. If used for prostate cancer, strain the urine first week to see if any seeds are secreted. Again, the seed itself is what's radioactive, not the urine. Intraperitoneal is unsealed, again, and it gives off low doses of radioactivity. So the main thing you need to think about is when you're caring for a patient, if you are caring for a cancer patient, is if they have internal radiation, is it sealed or unsealed? Sealed, they will not be radioactive. Their urine and their body fluids will not be radioactive. Whereas if it's unsealed, again, that's kind of spreads through the body and our urine or our sweat or our saliva, and therefore what we can come in contact with can be more radioactive. So let's then think about the next slide, which is internal radiation safety. So exposure to ionizing radiation is generally thought to be undesirable at any level, although there's no really medical or scientific evidence of harmful effects from low-dose exposure. So if you accidentally come across or get exposed to low doses of radiation, you probably will be just fine. Because we have been exposed to low doses of radiation from natural sources in the earth, our own bodies, and even outer space, which we don't even realize. So remember the one time, this was when cell phones came back. You guys are probably way too young to even remember this. But they thought that a man got brain cancer from the waves from his cell phone initially. And that has since been disproved. But that was a scare initially when cell phones came out. So you never know. Also, there is a maximum safe exposure to radiation according to the National Regulatory Commission, and you don't need to necessarily know that, but people who work in radiation, who work with chemo, who work in the radiation centers, or even work in x-ray, actually have to wear a badge to detect their level of radiation exposure, just to maintain that they're under that healthy level. Also, we're going to continue on the next slide there. When you're talking about someone who has internal radiation, there are going to be signs posted. There's going to be different things that you need to tell people if they're going to be coming in contact with someone who has radiation in them. So it's very important that you do not deny needed nursing procedures. You need to provide safe quality care to the patients, even if they have internal radiation. But use distance, shielding, and time to limit the exposure. So when you're thinking about each of these, with time, plan your jobs and do it as quickly as possible. Distance, radiation diminishes in proportion to the square of the distance. So the further you are from that patient, the less exposure you're going to be receiving. Shielding. Only a thick shield will help. Lead aprons are useless. So, especially with internal radiation. With radiation from an x-ray, the lead aprons are fine because it's low-dose radiation. When it's actually implanted, the lead aprons aren't necessarily going to be effective at all. You need the walls. So therefore, our time and our distance are really very important there as well. But remember, it's important to remember those three: distance, shielding, and time. On the next slide, some of those tips for helping us with our time, distance, and shielding is 15 minutes per nurse per shift. These are kind of guidelines, or 1 hour per 24 hours. Maximum allowed with internal radiation patients. Scheduled nurses in 2 to 4 hour time frames with these patients. Nurses need to wear the radiation badge so they can see how much exposure they've had. They need to wear a lead apron when in the room for some solid types. Again, the aprons themselves may not be real effective, but we're still going to probably wear them. Absolutely no pregnant women can go into the room. No one under the age of 18 can be in close contact with these patients for even up to 2 months post-procedure. It's important to NCLEX really loves the no pregnant, no kid rule with this one, so it's probably a good thing to remember. No students should take care of anyone with internal radiation, no volunteers. Visitors stay a minimum of 6 feet back from the bed, and they'll actually mark where that is on the floor, and visits 10 to 30 minutes per day. So these patients can feel very isolated and very lonely throughout this process. They're also going to hang a radiation hazard sign on the door, and these patients always, always, always have private rooms. And you can kind of see the next slide has that radiation sign on it, the radiation hazard sign. When we are using that or thinking about handling body fluids, make sure that we're disposing of them properly per our facility's policy. Keep all bed linens, gowns, dressings in appropriate containers until the source of the radiation is removed. If a solid implant is dislodged, use long-handled forceps and place in a lead container, and all of those should be right on the floor for you to use. If brachytherapy seeds are used for prostate cancer, we need to strain the urine wearing special gown and gloves, so we don't want to come in contact with the urine at all with our hands. Again, avoid close contact with others being treated. Limit sharing a bed, wearing condoms with sexual activity. Avoid pregnant women and kids, again, for 2 months after treatment. They can maintain some daily activities with rest periods as needed. We want them to continue to drink as much as possible, 2 to 3 liters per day. If the implant is temporary, they may need to maintain bed rest so the implant itself does not become dislodged. And again, that will be specific to the type of implant that they have. Excreted body fluids may also be radioactive if a soluble internal source is there. So double flush the toilet after it's used. Solid and seeds do not cause radioactivity of body fluids. So remember that. The way I remember that is anyone who has any internal radiation, whether it can be passed or not, I always try to double flush or remember to have that be double flushed. All right, some of the side effects from internal radiation can include fatigue, anorexia, immunosuppression. A lot of these sound familiar, so I'm kind of going to skip through them fast, and we'll talk about them again with chemo. Other side effects similar to external radiations, generally not skin hypersensitivity because they're internal. The radiation beam is not going through the skin, so we don't have that one. And with the prostate, they can have blood or blood clots in the urine. Should clear quickly, but we need to make sure that they still are able to void, that there's not a blood clot blocking the urethra itself. They may also have some groin bruising that you're going to see. The next slide showed some internal brachy seeds, some internal radiation seeds. That's actually what they look like. And the other thing to think about is radiation versus diagnostic imaging. A lot of people get very nervous when we think about x-rays and having CTs and MRIs done. And there's been some stuff in the news lately that talks about that some too. But the cancer risk is very, very low from x-rays. It's 0.6 to 3% of people who are exposed to those types of diagnostic procedure radiation that actually develop any form of cancer. But they still want us to avoid unnecessary x-rays, And our physicians nowadays are very good at helping us to avoid them if we do not need them. They will do a lot with ultrasound anymore to help with that risk. Let me think. I'm not going to necessarily go through the rest of those on that slide. Radiation therapy, again, radiation-induced cancer, timing to exposure. This next slide is just kind of a little bit of FYI. When you're exposed to a chemical warfare radiation at high doses, and we've seen that again after the Japanese atomic bombing, they had a peak in leukemia 5 to 9 years after the exposure. Other types can take longer to develop, 5 to 10 years. Head and neck radiation actually can cause cancer and seems to be carcinogenic, especially when exposed in the early years of life, when our normal cancer cells are they're destructed in some way. They can reform and mutate and actually cause a cancer cell at early ages. So we're learning more and more about radiation all the time, and we're making it more safe all the time, but there's still a lot of things to think about. I'm going to end this radiation podcast here. When we come back, we're going to talk about chemo and chemotherapy and things to think about when we use that.